worried about our relationship because I'm living with her right now. And since then, it's so much easier to take her. So that's pretty cool. So I got a few more.
Good. What do you do about people? Well, let's see. What do you do about people you can't find?
Write the engine anymore.
Huh?
Write the engine out anymore.
Yeah.
And stay willing to make it if you ever see them.
Exactly. And they have a habit of popping up. It's really kind of funny.
Yeah.
You have an experience like that?
I had one. Probably a few of them. I had one that was to do with the female. A lot of them to do with female. But I didn't have.
You're just bragging.
No, I didn't have it in a good way. I wrote it out to her and thought I'd never see her. And within a year, she wound up around Christmas time. I sent her shopping. And I went to make the amends to her and pulled her to the side. And she, you know, my ego, she didn't even remember who I was. But it turned out when I made the amends to her, you know, when I talked to her, she remembered me. And when I started making the amends and told her what I was going through and stuff, she told me that 30 days prior to me making that amends that she had gotten involved in AA and was working the program.
Wow.
So that kind of, but it wasn't word for word off the paper that I have written out, but I thought that, well, I'd seen her, I'd better take the time.
Right.
So I guess maybe that was intuitive about the feeling.
So you, if you have someone you can't find, you just become ready to do it. And if it shows up, fine, and if it doesn't. What if someone won't talk to you? What do you do?
Write a letter.
Can? Sure. What if they won't respond?
Write a letter.
Well, you won't know if they won't respond unless you send it to them, right? Yeah. But what if you really want to get over in front of somebody and make amends and they just refuse to see you? Huh? Yeah, you do. We don't go get in other people's faces to make our deal right. Okay? Right. Right. So you don't do that. Any of you guys have any questions that you've faced in amends? Yeah.
You know, I was very active in my alcoholism when the relationship started and failed. And one of them, I was afraid that, you know, I had done enough harm to. And I didn't want to hurt her anymore. And part of that was my ego thinking that the way I would harm her was that, you know, she'd fall in love with me. So, you know, I mean, it took a while for me to realize that was the truth. You know,
that was the first amends we want to learn out today.
So, I did my best to find an address that was current for her. I wrote it out, had my sponsor look at it, and I mailed it to her and forgot about it. And I was willing, and I did. I think I did the right thing. And the intention was never to get in front of her or to get a reply.
Right.
Just to try to clean the slate my side of the street. Yeah, and admit where I was wrong. And the other one is an ex-wife. I don't know where she is. And I kind of feel like part of me is I don't want to hurt her anymore. Part of me is, you know, well, you know, if she hurt for me, that might make her fall in love with me all over again, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we just weren't right for each other. So, that one I haven't pursued finding so diligently. Although we have so many, we work in the same business, so we have so many friends. She's going to pop up. I just know she's going to.
Okay.
So I've got it written and ready if that happens.
I don't know if this qualifies as a community, but can we make amends to ourselves?
Yeah, I think so, but some people would argue with that.
I had a thing where, for years, at least 3 times a week, I would have dreams about the house that I used to own and that was foreclosed on. And that's where my family went. Everything fell apart towards the end. And in the dream, I would always be in the house, and I'd walk in the house would be empty, and then some of the people would walk in, and they'd tell me, you're in my house, and then the fear and the everything would come on me, and then I would wake up, and I could never understand that, and I finally went up to the house with another alcoholic who went with me, and I went to the house and visited, and I realized that it was a part of me that I wasn't with Joe, that wasn't forgiving, and I could, you know, start saying prayers over that, and it worked.
Yes.
I realized at that point that I wasn't forgiving myself. I was asking people to forgive me, but I wasn't asking myself to let go of those things.
Mm-hmm. Are there amends that you can't make?
When would injure them or others?
Right. Yeah, if you go injure them or others.
Yeah, like if you... A triangle, blood triangle or something.
Yeah, that's a good example.
Then the big book says approach from the flank.
In some cases, yeah. The problem with things in those kind of triangles or relationships in general is that the harm that you create has a tendency to have a ripple effect. And that means that you harm them, and like, let's say you're messing around with somebody's wife. The tendency is to harm her and you. You know both of you are going to get harmed. And if she has kids, there's a good chance you harm those kids. If you have kids, you may harm your kids. You know you harm the spouse. You can harm the parents. You can get in the middle and mess up somebody. And it has this ripple effect that goes out. And sometimes it's hard to get to those people and make amends. Now, the classic example is going to the injured spouse and saying, I'm sorry I was messing with your wife. Huh?
Yeah. And so some things are better off, I'd
say. Yeah. I mean, the deal is here that you can't put someone else at risk to clean your side of the street.
Right, and aren't amends for us more than other people will make amends to? Is that how we go after that? There's also the ability to let them to forgive us so they can let go of the sickness too, or part of our work.
It's both.
Like, I think you always lose them over and they don't remember what you did.
That's based on being self-centered and thinking
right.
We're so important.
Right.
But still, isn't it? It's about not just us being free, but setting them free from it too, if they're having a resentment about it.
You can both benefit from it, certainly. But the trick is, do you have the courage to go follow this sort of spiritual path and put your ego in your pocket and go out there and put yourself at risk? It's really hard to do. There are parts of this program that are absurdly hard to do.
I was in risk of losing my job making my amends to my board.
Yes.
I stole from him.
Yes. So. What happened?
He didn't care. By the time I made that amends, I was sober almost a year and a half. And he was just glad to see me showing up at work every day and working 8 hours. You know?
Yeah.
So that was kind of a living amends already going by that time. And when I made this amends to him, man, I was shaking. The paper was shaking. I was almost in tears. And he was sitting there smiling the whole time.
Right.
You know? And we get done, and he goes, and I go, is there anything you'd like to add? And he goes, no, it's good to have you back. Get back to work, you know. And it was water under the bridge, he had, you know. And I was just twisted.
Right.
And he didn't care.
Right. See, we carry that stuff around, and we have this fear of being found out and all the consequences that are attached to that. And it can absolutely kill us. The problem, we didn't talk about fear and sex inventory, did we?
No.
Isn't that interesting? Let's just touch on that before we go on. So how do you write a fear inventory? I remember we got started with that. How do you write it?
I did it the same way as the rest of them.
You wrote it in columns? Okay, some people do that.
Corrected, fear-corrected, how did fear play a part in this?
Okay. Some people just write down all their fears and ask, wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Yeah. Okay?
The fears came out of the inventory.
Resentment inventory?
Yes, right out of the resentment inventory, then just made another
right.
column.
Made a column.
Yeah, made a column of the fears, columns, and that's how I got
it. Isn't there a difference too, though? Because the first time I did mine, I didn't do fear bracketed alongside the columns. And man, I was told just to make a fears list. And then when I started doing them again, then I was told to make the fears bracket alongside the columns to see how fears intertwined and things I did. And then it made more sense and you were going to solve and how it played a big part.
You know, I just follow the directions on that one and just write a whole bunch of fears and then ask that question about each one of them. And that's what I do. Okay? Seems to work fine.
I did on the third column. Each one of those had a fear list.
They're all
really affected.
It talks about chains of circumstances. And
the fears were with each one of those, and if those ones are over, you know, brought down to common fears.
Right.
That's what I
mean. Well, I think that's a good exercise. All right. What does it mean, wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Okay. The question basically is, in the absence of God, do I have a reason to be afraid of all of these things? Yeah, you bet. I got reason. I've got clear reason to be afraid of everything I got on that list. And in the presence of God, which one of these things should I fear?
None.
If I'm standing in God's presence, the only thing that can happen to me is what He wants to happen to me. And I already agreed to that. Okay? I remember when this guy that I sponsor came up and said, I didn't sign up for this shit. And I said, yeah, you did. You made the deal. You got on your knees and held hands with me and made the deal. And now you want to back out of the deal and it isn't going to work. Okay? How do you write sex inventory? Huh?
About every personal relationship.
About every intimate relationship.
That's what I meant,
Yeah.
Where could I be wrong, arouse suspicion or jealousy?
Right, answer the questions. Where did I arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Was it selfish or not?
Always.
Huh?
Always.
Always, yeah. Did you ever look to see whether jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness were things you used? They're tools. They're tools to keep people off balance. I think that's why it's in there. Yeah, and probably Bill Wilson.
Yeah.
And so...
Well, Bill said the drinking, though, it kept him from those kind of scrapes.
There are very few people that actually believe that. That's a nice idea. But we use jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness to keep our spouses off balance, so they never get a clear look at us, because most of us have such a depleted sense of self-worth that we think if this lady or guy that we're hanging out with ever gets a good, clean look at us, they're going to be out of there faster than we can, okay?
I thought women like the man with
mystery. Oh, shit. That's a delusion.
That,
Huh?
Yeah.
So you just, now at the end of, so you answer the questions. Was it salvaged or not? What should I have done instead? It's an interesting one because it always comes up with the same answer. I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
Huh? Now, at the end of that, and this is really interesting, it talks about a sane and sound sexual ideal. What's that look like?
I don't know.
It's all right. Anybody written an ideal? You can't have an ideal unless you consider it and unless you write it down. If you're going to have a sane and sound sexual ideal, you better write it out. Because it's going to it says that if we don't live up to this, that means it has to be defined. And that we are going to attempt to live by an ideal in that area. Does anybody have any idea what that looks like? What?
Yeah.
Did you? Good for you. What did you write down?
A lot of trusting God kind of stuff. Not looking to other people where I can only get from God kind of stuff.
Okay. So what you're just not replacing God with some guy, basically, and putting your reliance upon him?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When you write a sexual ideal, the ideal, the most productive way to write that, at least from a whole lot of people's experience, including my own, is to write an ideal about what we bring to the relationship. All right? Now, I remember guys writing sexual ideals and they'd go, let's see, about 5'5", 135, blonde, you know, yeah. And they said, that's my sexual ideal. And you go, no, it's not. Yeah.
That's fine. Big bucket of chicken. One of the things that I found that was important was that he was told to me about, and it's don't write some kind of idea for some kind of safe thing you can't do.
Right.
Make it practical.
Well, the whole business about placing someone else's welfare above your own is a good way to start. And if you really love someone, trying to make their life as pleasant as you can is an effective way to be in a relationship. You can use other things. I can tell you what's in mine. It's loving. It's about good communication. Now, when things start going south in relationships, I just want to blow them off. I don't want to be there. I don't want to get in the arguments. Sitting down nose to nose with some woman and saying this really doesn't work and I really love you and want this relationship to continue and we need to figure out a way to make this work for both of us. I would rather be shot than to have to sit down nose to nose with someone and get into that kind of conversation. I just despise them. But I'm willing to do it. So part of it is being a good communicator. Because I don't care who you are, there are going to be differences in every relationship. And your tolerance for that, and your ability to communicate and to try and resolve it reasonably with the other person is what makes those things last long. So loving, tolerant, communicative, placing others' welfare above your own, seeking compatibility in every area. I don't know. My mind's a little blank. Yes.
Talking about the future and us as a couple and
hands, I immediately shut down. He was not emotionally there for the next whatever month or so. And, you know, eventually that ended. It was totally selfish.
Right.
And I realize now that if I'm going to be with somebody, that I have to get that idea totally out. If I'm going to be with somebody, I'm going to be with somebody. I'm going to have to work on the internet, regardless of what she says. Let's talk about the future.
Right.
And I can actually talk about it now and share where I am as far as I'm going to be here now. And yes, there's a possibility. I'm not ruling out the possibility of happily ever after.
Right.
Even though my idea is an illusion. But still, you know, to address that.
Yes. Men are notorious for being unavailable and for total lack of commitment. And that's not a good way to do it. But I mean, you got to fish or cut bait at some point. And from a lot of ladies' points of view, the sooner the better.
I was going to say that I had a single situation like what you were talking about. And I thought it was fine because in the book it talks about no man is smarter than a man about the pepperoni diet. And my sponsor told me as long as both parties agree, it's okay.
Right.
But the same thing kind of happened. And what I realized, just because somebody says okay doesn't mean that they're actually saying it's okay.
They
say it's okay, but somewhere behind that they may have be something wrong and they're just looking for it for the wrong reason. And I have to look beyond my, you know, with the whole picture as a whole.
Right.
It hardly ever turns out to be where it can just be that.
He's trying to tell us what we want to hear.
Everyone comes into these with their own agendas. And they have to be compatible for this thing to work over any extended period of time. Huh? Are we out? Okay, so we're going to come back when this thing, sometime here soon. And we're going to talk about 10, 11, and 12. All right. This, at the end of the ninth step are the promises. And I wouldn't be looking at those promises unless I did the first nine steps. Okay? Because it's the nine steps that makes them happen. This thought brings us to step 10, and I'm going to read this because there isn't much to it, which suggests that we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of life as we cleaned up the past. So you can commence to do this while you're doing your amends, all right? That doesn't mean you stop doing your amends. It means you can start doing the 10th step. We have entered the world of the Spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for a lifetime. Here's the directions. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. If you wrote an inventory, you know what all those things feel like. And so you continue to watch for them. When they crop up, and they will, okay, it isn't like this isn't going to happen. We ask God at once to remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. So here's what you do. You watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And when it comes up, you ask God at once to remove it. Okay? You talk to someone about it. You make amends if you've harmed someone. But the trick is to resolutely turn your thoughts to someone you can help. Here's why. Selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear is our alcoholism. And after we've done all this work, if that stuff comes up, and it will, then the trick is here's what happens. If you're selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, you're frightened. You start turning inward. And the only thing we start thinking about again is ourselves. And that's dangerous for people like us. So the way you avoid that, or the way you get out of it, is to turn your thoughts to someone you can help. When we're in that, we're just thinking about us. So the idea is to turn outward, and start thinking about how you can help someone else. Now, people will say, well, so should I just go help somebody? And that isn't what it says. It says, think about helping somebody. Okay? That's all it requires to get out of your own head, is to start thinking about someone that you can help. In Denver, we have what are called 10-step buddies. And what we do is we find a couple of people and we call them up and we say, look, if I get into this selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, or fear, and I need to talk to someone in the 10-step, can I call you and will you listen? And then they will agree to that or they won't. I have about a half a dozen people I can call at any time, tell them I need to 10-step something, and they'll listen to me. So I call up and I say, I'm really in fear about this or that, or I'm really angry, resentful at this person. And I'll tell them what's going on. The first thing they do is they say, have you asked God to remove it? And the next thing they say is, have you turned your thoughts to someone you can help? Okay? It really helps to call someone on this because when you get in the middle of half of this stuff, you lack perspective. One of the things you'll learn about life if you write enough inventory is that things are rarely what they seem to be. That's just a fact. So if there's anything that we as alcoholics suffer from, it is faulty perception. And we will take some little set of facts and immediately go to the worst possible scenario with them, and then we'll build a house there and start decorating. That's what happens. And the truth is that it's faulty perception. And so one of the benefits of having friends in Alcoholics Anonymous that you can 10-step with is that they can give you a different perspective. They are an uninvolved third party. And when they are uninvolved, they can give you a much clearer perspective. Plus, they can get you back on a spiritual path by getting you to turn your thoughts. Do you have any questions about that? New people in Alcoholics Anonymous don't want 10-step. And the reason why is because they keep putting their ego at risk. You know, you don't want to call up somebody and say, hey, I'm really kind of a dumbass for getting myself in this position, and I'm really angry, or I'm really resentful, or I'm really afraid. New people in AA don't want to do that. And it's because they put their ego at risk. And, older people in AA do it all the time. And it's just because I don't care about my ego. I'm trying to kill the son of a bitch anyway. So, and the problem with the ego is you can't kill it. All you can do is deflate it and wait for it to regenerate. So 10-stepping is another way to deflate the ego. It also keeps us out of those things that make us turn inward, that make us much more susceptible to a drink. So I would encourage you to do 10 steps. I probably do one every day. If something comes up, I just don't want to live that way. I don't want to be walking around with some resentment in my head because it makes me ineffective in everything else I do. So I'll call up somebody and say, hey, I need to 10-step something. Here's what's going on. They'll say, did you do this? Did you do that? Are you really sure it's what you think it is? And then we'll talk about it and get straight, and then we'll go on with the day. Okay? That's what 10-stepping looks like. And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. Just as an aside, if you meet someone in Alcoholics Anonymous that is crazy, that has already gone through the 10th step, if they're real alcoholics, it's because they want to be. Because this book says by this time sanity will have returned. So if you see somebody that's already been through the steps and they're acting crazy, it's an act of the will. Okay? Now, it could be they're not alcoholic. That's a whole different deal. But it says by this time sanity will have returned, and I believe it. By that time, sanity returns. If you've done all that work, that's going to happen. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. I've had that experience. Just virtually step back. Just automatically step back from alcohol. We react sanely and normally. Is that right? Yeah. We react sanely and normally, and we'll find out that this has happened automatically. We'll see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That's the miracle of it. We're not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we'd been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We've not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react as long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. If someone would have told me that the first day that I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I would reach a point where I would be neutral about alcohol after I had spent the last 10 or 15 years letting alcohol make every decision for me in my life, I would have told them they were full of crap. But the truth is that I am neutral to alcohol. I am indifferent to alcohol. I don't think about drinking. I don't think about alcohol. It just doesn't come up. It's like looking at a dog food ad. I don't have a dog. It's just irrelevant to me. Don't make any sense. Okay? And the idea that I would be able to be that nonchalant about alcohol is absurd. I spent most of my early life being wrapped around a bottle of booze. So, it is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We're headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We're not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It's the proper use of the will. The proper use of the will is to do God's will. Okay? That's the proper use of the will. Now, how do we carry the vision of God's will into all our activities? Yeah. Just say, God, come with me. All right? Well, I'll give you an interesting experiment if you want to do it. When you get up in the morning, say, God, I invite you into my day. I would like you to be here with me, and I would like you to participate with me in this day. From my experience, the one thing about God, one of the things I know, or I think I know about God, is that he's polite. Which means he isn't going to go anywhere where he's not asked. If you don't want God to be there, God won't be there. And the trick is, maybe you ought to ask him. And so when you get up in the morning, if you want to do this experiment, invite God into your day and see what happens. We carry the vision of God's will into all our activities by asking God to be part of all our activities. I asked this lady that I was dating with, I said, she actually was in the program, and I said, maybe we ought to invite God into the bedroom also. And it was just like, are you sure you want to do that? I went, uh-huh. Yeah, if I'm inviting God into all my activities, that's one activity I'd like him to be part of. And I don't know what that looks like, but I'd sure like to find out. It's just fine. You know what? It's just fine. Much has already been said about receiving strength, inspiration, and direction from him who has all knowledge and power. If we have carefully followed directions, we've begun to sense the flow of his spirit into us. To some extent, we've become God conscious. We've begun to develop this vital sixth sense, but we must go further, and that means more action. Remember, the 10th step is continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When you see it, ask God at once to remove it. Make amends quickly to anyone you've harmed. Talk to someone about it and resolutely turn your thoughts to someone you can help. That's how you do that. Don't be afraid to show others that you're not leading a perfect life. We all do that. And if you're embarrassed or afraid, get over it. Step 11. Suggest prayer and meditation. We shouldn't be shy on this matter of prayer. Better men than we are using it constantly. It works if we have the proper attitude and work at it. It would be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite valuable suggestions. Here are the suggestions. When we retire at night, now I can tell you before I go into the directions that I don't believe that 10% of all the people in Alcoholics Anonymous do this. Okay? And they're really missing the boat. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do we owe an apology? Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? Were we kind and loving towards all? What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time? Or were we thinking of what we could do for others, of what we could pack into the stream of life? Ask yourself those questions when you retire at night. But we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, because that would diminish our usefulness to others. Why would we drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection? Huh?
Tired of seeing it.
Hey, what?
Tired of seeing it.
Yeah. And the other thing is that nobody's perfect. And so you go, well, I screwed up again. That's morbid reflection, okay? This isn't about beating yourself up. It's taking a look at how well you did today. And if you didn't do as well as you did yesterday, or you did better or whatever, it's just you taking a look at it. After making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. You know how you do that? Say, God, what corrective measure should I take? Right? That's it. On awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. If you're going to consider your plans for the day, you got to have some. easiest way to do that is to do them the night before. I do mine on a PDA, or sometimes I do them on a legal pad. But what it does is you can write down 10 or 12 or 15 or whatever things you want to do tomorrow. And then when you get up in the morning, you review them. See whether your mind's changed while you were sleeping. There's two things that are always on my list. One of them is try to make someone else's life better. And the other one is be happy. Now, why would that be on my list?
Giving it yourself.
I don't do that well. You know, I'm not a person who is naturally happy. And I wish I was. But I have to work at being happy. Isn't that awful? So I have to remind myself in the morning to be happy. And then I can be happy most of the time. But if I just forget about it, I don't. I'm not good at it. So those things are always on my list. The other things that are on my list are things that relate to business. You know, if I've got a lunch planned with someone, or if I have some other things that people I have to contact, all kinds of things like that. Some of it has to do with AA. Do I get all those things done every day? No. I get most of them done. And about every 2 weeks, I turn the list upside down. Because sometimes you don't ever get to them. And so you turn around and the last one on the list becomes the first one. And that's where you start. Okay? Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, and self-seeking motives. How do you do that?
Ask.
Yeah. Say, God, please direct my thinking, especially that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, and self-seeking motives. This is really tough stuff. Okay. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance, for after all, God gave us brains to use. Now, there is a paradox here. You know, on the one side, it says, for after all, God gave us brains to use. And on the other side, someone's barking in your ear, your very best thinking got you here. Right? So what's right? Yeah, I mean, the one comment's right. My best thinking did get me here. But the truth is that I can use my mind with some degree of clarity today. And the idea that every time I'm going to touch something, I'm going to screw it up is just BS. I just, God gave us brains to use. So go out there and make some decisions. Try rational thinking. We all are capable of it, but see, sometimes people come in here, and if they have these overbearing sponsors, just go, you better call me before you do anything. Flies in the face of, we're on a new basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. If you are someone's sponsor and you make them rely on you for everything you do or they do, you are preventing them from recovering. Okay? If they don't learn how to trust God, they're never going to reach God. They're going to follow you around like a puppy, and you're going to tell them about half the time you're going to be wrong. All right? So teach them to trust God. The way my sponsor did that to me was by constantly telling me, why don't you pray about it and do what you think? On awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. I read that. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance, for after all, God gave us brains to use. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. In thinking about our day, we may face indecision. That happens a lot, all right? We may face indecision. Here we ask God for inspiration and intuitive thought or a decision. We relax and take it easy. We don't get in some kind of big tizzy about what the answer is. We just sit back and relax. We don't struggle. This isn't a struggle. You just say, God, I need to know what the answer is here. And we're often surprised how the right answers come after we've tried this for a while. It's an interesting exercise. What used to be the hunch or the occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. Okay? They're talking about intuitive thought. Being still and experienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it's not probable that we're going to be inspired at all times. We may pay for this presumption in all sorts of absurd action and ideas. Nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration. We come to rely upon it. So if you want to know if your intuitive thought's working, try it out. Go find out, do it over an extended period of time, and you will come to rely on it. And other people will go, how do you know that? You go, I just know that. Okay? That really works. I mean, that sounds a little spooky, but if you go try that, you'll be amazed by the results. Excuse me? Yeah. Let's see. I'll see someone in an AA meeting, and my intuitive thought will tell me that I need to walk up and say something that isn't going to make me look awful. I went to this meeting, and there was this woman in the back of the meeting, and she was weeping, and she was doing such a magnificent job of it that everyone in the meeting was around her, and they were all stroking her and telling her we're going to be all right. And I had watched this woman come in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for about 5 or 6 years. And so they were going around the room and asking everybody to talk, and when it got around to me, I said, well, the first thing I want to talk about is that burned out woman that's sitting over there that's got her head stuck up her ass, and everybody's stroking her and telling her it's going to be all right, and it's a lie. My intuition told me to say that. And you know, you go, no, that's mean, ugly. That's a terrible thing to say to anyone under the circumstances. Now, I'll tell you what, the next day she put herself in a treatment center, and sometime after that she came up to me and she said, Bob, you were the only person I heard in that old meeting. Now, here's the deal. You go do that in a meeting and you polarize the whole meeting right there. Everybody in that meeting is going to make an instant decision that you're the biggest asshole that ever came down the road. Do you have the courage to follow your intuition? Do you, if what you hear is you need to really get someone's attention, even if it makes you look badly, if it makes you look like a total jerk, are you willing to stand up and do it? And if you trust your intuition, you'll do it. Okay? How's that for an example? Yes.
Can I share one more?
No, go ahead.
A couple of years ago, I went out to Utah with some amends. And I got those amends out of the way, and I went back to my hotel. And when you know you're done, I thought I was going to be in Utah for 2 days. And I was done, it's time to go home. I met some guys at a meeting before that I used to go to one week. And I'm at home in this hotel, just waiting for the morning to come and take off. And I can't sleep. And it's about 10 o'clock at night. And, I had been invited to somebody's house. I didn't know very well before, and I just didn't want to go there. You know? So I'm at home in this hotel, and my intuition says, go to the old club. got that midnight meeting, just go to, I don't want to go across the room, but can't sleep on that. And so I go over there, and they're not having a meeting because you gotta dance. And I'm going, nah, that's right. But since I'm here, I'm gonna get a cup of coffee and sit down and get this coffee to go. And the craziest guy in that meeting in the afternoon that earlier, a friend in 3 days, 2 days in the saw me, got me out ear to ear, way out in the corner, in a beeline room. And long story short, 5 hours later, we were doing a third step program. We did bouncing in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. 3 years, we never heard the doctor's opinion. Never heard anything about first step as we see it in the big book, any of that stuff. And that morning, I was able to hand them off to the guy that sponsored me. Went through the rest of the steps. I got still sober.
Yes.
And I found out that going out there wasn't necessarily about making money.
Right.
It was about something else.
Right.
And if I had got out of that bed, I don't know what would have happened.
Right.
And it happens so often. And it's, I shouldn't say so often. Just one more thing.
Things are rarely what they seem to be. And if you know that about life, you're better armed. This it truly is about faulty perception. And most of the time I think something's going on and nothing's going on or something different's going on or whatever. But my mind draws all sorts of erroneous conclusions about everything. And sometimes we think we're on a mission and it's not the mission at all. All right? I spoke at AA conventions once a month for about 25 years. You know, I was booked like 2-3 years ahead. And I was coming back from Tampa, Florida, from a convention, got on a plane, sat back like this. I have never heard voices in my life. Sat back, just relaxed, and I heard clear as a bell, "You're done." And I thought, wonder what the hell that means. And I understood that it was, that's enough. So I was booked like 2 or 3 years, and I had agreed to do all that, so I did it, and then I stopped going. And I felt like I got fired from my spiritual job, and I thought, why would God do that to me? Maybe I'm gonna die. And I went to my sponsor and I said, honest to God, I heard a voice. And he said, okay. And I said, well, what does that mean? Does that mean I'm going to die, that my time's up here, and that you're just telling me that you don't have to do this anymore? What the hell's going on? And he said, no, you probably just get a different job. See, we all have our regular jobs, but we also have spiritual jobs too. And spiritual jobs are like regular jobs. You just have to go do them. You don't have to like them. You just have to do them. So, and you all know what your spiritual jobs are, even if you think you don't. So, so I spent the next 4 years, I suppose, not doing it. Just staying home, working with my kids, coaching Little League soccer, trying to keep my marriage together. Soccer worked great, the marriage didn't. And that was the way it worked. And then one day, it was all right to go do this again. And that's all intuition. That's all letting God speak to you through your intuition. So, all right. We usually conclude this period of meditation with a prayer that we be shown all through the day what our next step is to be, that we be given whatever we need to take care of such problems. We ask especially for freedom from self-will and are careful to make no request for ourselves, only we may ask for ourselves, however, if others will be helped. We are careful never to pray for our own selfish ends. Many of us have wasted a lot of time doing that, and it doesn't work. You can easily see why. And you just follow what it says there in the prayer. If circumstances warrant, we ask our wives or friends to join us in morning meditation. If we belong to a religious denomination which requires a definite morning devotion, we attend to that also. If not members of religious bodies, we sometimes select or memorize a few set prayers which emphasize the principles we've been discussing. There are many helpful books also. Suggestions about these may be obtained from one's priest, minister, or rabbi. Be quick to see where religious people are right. Make use of what they offer. I remember when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and everybody was really beaten on the Catholic Church. That flies directly in the face of what this book says. You know, a lot of us got mad at religions, and it wasn't the religion, it was us. We go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. We constantly remind ourselves we are no longer running the show. We paused when agitated or doubtful. Do you know what agitated or doubtful feels like? Pause. One of the big problems is that people don't pause. They just launch. Okay? And here, what it says, and it's an interesting exercise, and I can tell you, I've been doing it for a long time. And I do it more or less automatically most of the time now, not all of the time. But I'll just pause, and sometimes I'll physically step back and say, God, show me what's going on here. And it keeps me from doing all sorts of absurd things. Okay? So when I'm agitated or doubtful, I just stop and ask him for the right thought or action. We constantly remind ourselves we're no longer running the show, humbly saying to ourselves many times each day, thy will be done. I know people that have those little electronic watches that beep every hour, and every time it beeps, they say, thy will be done. And it's to remind them to do that, to stay on a spiritual basis. We are then in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. We become much more efficient. We don't tire so easily, for we're not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we were trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. It works, it really does. We alcoholics are in discipline, so we let God discipline us in the simple way that we've just outlined. The 11th step is about discipline. Make no mistake about it. And in this way, God disciplines us. And so the great virtue in this, in the 11th step, which is what so few people do, is to follow the directions in every day. And here's what happens. It says what you do when you retire at night, which is turn to God. It says what to do when you get up in the morning, which is turn to God. It says what you should do as you go through the day. We pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action, saying many times each day, thy will be done, and turn to God. And what it does is it puts us in the position where we're constantly turning to God. Okay? That's the nature of that. But this is not all. There's action and more action. Faith without works is dead. The next chapter is about step 12. So we're going to talk about step 12. Now, I'm going to tell you, because I think that Matt asked about this, how the program came to me. In 1975, there was a world conference in Denver. And a bunch of guys, including some old-timers that some of you may have heard about, named Gary Brown and Don Pritz and Ernie Martinez, and there were a whole bunch of them, and I all went to work on this international convention. We, most of us, were on the I don't know what the hell, committee, hospitality committee. So they set up, and there were 17,000, this is in 1975, there were 17,000 alcoholics showed up in Denver. And we were all kind of hanging around, listening to everybody. Lois Wilson was there. And there was a guy who showed up from Winnipeg. His name was Mac Cheater. He's dead now. And he talked about a group called the Golden Slippers. Golden Slippers were in Winnipeg. And the reason why they call them the Golden Slippers was because nobody could stay sober. And he said that they had, that they out of necessity had changed their mind about Alcoholics Anonymous. And that they had found a whole new way to be members of AA, that they weren't going to rationalize about the steps, and they weren't going to intellectualize about the steps, and that they were going to take a whole new approach in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is that they were going to do the steps. And as a consequence, they started at the forward to the first edition where it says to show others precisely how we have recovered. Precisely how we have recovered, which means there's got to be directions in the middle of that, is the main purpose of this book. And they started at the forward to the first edition, and they went through the book as a group. And they all individually did everything that the book said to do. And an amazing thing happened. The Golden Slippers no longer drank. Now, there were about 15 of us in Denver when he was up there talking about that, that had, he had our rapt attention. And we're sitting there going, whoa, wonder what that looks like. And so after the convention, we all got together at York Street, 15 of us, and said, why don't we do that? And we got together in this guy named Jay Levy's basement, and we started at the forward to the first edition and did everything that Mac Cheater described. Out of the 15 of us, 14 never drank. And the only guy that ever drank was a guy named Eddie Durkin. And Eddie went out. Denver is not a warm place in the winter, as you know. And Eddie went out on the street and laid down in a doorway in downtown Denver and froze to death. Drunk. And the rest of us never drank. Now I know that there is a direct correlation between sobriety and following directions. And if you think that you can come into Alcoholics Anonymous and half-ass your way through here, you are blowing smoke up your own butt. This is about the spiritual virtue of following someone else's directions and doing them precisely. And if you are willing to do that, you will have the same protection that all of us receive by having done that and continuing to do that. Now, if you have any regard at all for people coming into Alcoholics Anonymous who are real alcoholics and can find no solution, you better be clear. You better be able to tell them what you did. My sponsor used to, when we'd get through a step, he'd say, do you know what you did? And I would describe what I did. And he'd say, the only way that you're ever going to be able to be of real help to other alcoholics is by being able to show other people in this program exactly how you followed the directions. Our job is to be clear. whether somebody else wants it or not is based on their need. When we work with other people, we are not responsible for their sobriety. They are. We do not put our ego in the middle of the process. If they drink, it is not a reflection upon our ability to carry this message. If they drink because drunks drink. If we have carried a clear message and they have shown the willingness to follow the directions, they will get sober and they will stay sober. Any other approach to Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't work. So the question, I suppose, that you may want to consider is, am I clear? Am I precise? Am I fearless? Am I willing to look like a fool? Am I willing to look like an asshole? Am I willing to be disliked by everyone in the room to tell the truth? Do I have the courage of my convictions? Just what the hell is it that I stand for? Ask yourself those questions and find out where you come up. And if you don't know how to, if you don't know what the whole answer is, find the whole answer. If you haven't done everything the way the book says, go do that. Everything the book says. And then go find some sick, sorry, suffering person that has no idea at all how to recover. And show them how to live again. You can bring hope into people's lives that have... You virtually can save other people through your knowledge of this program. You can bring people back from the gates of death by showing them what to do. Do you want to do that? Or you want to just take up space here? If you want to do that, learn this program and then be free with it. And when you see somebody suffering from alcoholism, get up in front of them and say, you want to know the truth about this? And do you want to know how to recover? And if you do, I'll take the time to show you. And if you do that, you fulfill your promise to Alcoholics Anonymous and you fulfill your promise to God. And if you don't want to do that, you're a total waste of time. That's it.